Ecclesiastes chapter 9, Brother Adams kind of indicates in this that there is a rejoicing that is present in this particular book, in this particular chapter, although it is one that does have some discussion of negative and sobering thoughts as well. And I told you this when we started our class. I want to appreciate and like every single application he makes, but I think sometimes he's got an agenda that he just stretches the text a little bit, and I think he does that a couple of times late in this chapter. I want to address that because he wants it to be all positive, and there are some negative things that are mentioned in this particular chapter. But there is much cause for us to rejoice, and the first cause for that is was actually the first point, major point in the lesson, and that is that God is in control. And while that does not mean, when we're told that our life is in the hands of God, that we're going to avoid difficulties in our lives or suffering, what it does mean is that God is supreme, God is sovereign, God reigns, and He cares for us. And so this life can and should be a blessing. Last Sunday, you'll remember, not last Sunday, but the Sunday previous, I brought a lesson entitled Rejoice. And I think that our default state as Christians should be a happiness and joy in our lives. And that's certainly something he ascribes to, because now he brings God into the picture, where a life that does not have God in the picture is a life that ultimately is without meaning, which is a very depressing concept. If God is in the picture, then the very things that he says are vain things are things that can cause us happiness. When he talks about childhood being vanity, well, it certainly is if God's not in the picture. But we rejoice not only in our own youth as we look fondly back upon it, but in the young people and the enthusiasm and the joy for life that they have is something that we see there is value as long as it's put in its proper perspective. And the same thing can be said with regard to our recreation and entertainment. It can be said with regard to laughter and happiness. It can be said with regard to the work that you do. All of these things, if they have the proper perspective, they are as they are because they are as God intended them to be, and he intends for us to enjoy them and rejoice in them. And they do have value if God's in the picture. It's just if God's not, that they do not. So he kind of brings God back into the picture in this chapter. So there's much good to be pointing out. Now, the second point was death is certain. And so death is the evil thing that exists as a result of sin and rebellion against God. And that's, of course, the reason for the necessity of redemption, so that there'll be life after death. The third point, which is where we're going to be today, is that without God, man is mean and mad. And the reference is to verse 3 in Ecclesiastes 9. And that this is an evil in all that is done under the sun. One thing happens to all. Truly, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that, they go to the dead. Now, that is, I think, a fairly accurate statement concerning the way the world is in general, because men are without God, typically. And we live in that world that can often be cruel and difficult for us to manage because of the opposition to the things that are right and good that are present. When you think about the way in which men are without God's values intervening, then there is that descent into depravity. Culturally, that's the case. I think that's why the Apostle Paul was referring to in Romans 1 when he talked about the pagans who no longer retain God in their knowledge, so God gave them over to a debased mind to do things that are not fitting. When you forget God, then the tendencies trend downward to where there is degradation and sin. He refers to it in two ways. He calls it evil and madness. And I do think the madness here, the word, is referencing craziness or insanity. In other words, men act in unrational ways. if God is not present in their lives. So I think it can be rightly said, using that parallel in Romans 1, that a debased mind is a mind that is irrational. And again, what you see when you look at culture today very much is that kind of thing, where values that are completely opposed to the things of God are being advocated, and where dark is light and good is evil. And you know, it's hard for us to contemplate, for example, a culture, just use the changes in the concepts of gender, to deny the reality that there are men and women. And basically that's all there are, men and women. There was a child, I just read this yesterday, who was expelled from school. No, he was kicked out of university class. There is an appeal ongoing, and this, I didn't read this article, I just noted that I'd already read an article about it. It may be that he lost out on his appeal, but he was kicked out of class by a university professor because he disagreed with the concept that there are two genders and that gender is hardwired, which is something that until no more than a decade ago was accepted by all of society. So within the last 10 years, and really it's only become a popular thing in the last 4 or 5, but within the last years, all of a sudden it is now immoral to try to contend for the concept of a man and a woman as God created them. And because he was being, in her view, argumentative, showing a lack of respect for her authority as a teacher, he was told in the class that at that point in time only the women were allowed to speak, and they were talking about allowed to make comments with regard to a proper respect for this concept of gender fluidity, and she was shutting any of the young men out as far as the discussion goes. And anyway, he objected to it and probably raised a little bit of a ruckus. Adolescent men can, or adolescent boys, 18-year-olds, 17-year-olds, whatever, they can be disrespectful. So I have no doubt there was some disrespect being shown. But I just thought it was an interesting thing that in our so-called tolerant society, Christian values are no longer tolerated. That's kind of where it's gotten, and it's a shame. But the thing is, when you see that kind of the madness of it, the it's crazy. Things are getting crazy with regard to the world things. And so it's not surprising that we would have a hard time wrapping our minds around these changes. They've been coming so quickly, and they're so opposed not only to what we stand for, but what we consider to be common sense, and yet they're being embraced. And so I think there is something to be said about a debased mind, that there is some madness that is tied in with that. When individuals can speak rationally and actually morally oppose those who are only using logic and things that people have believed and understood to be the case for centuries. And because we don't jump on board with them immediately, all of a sudden we're immoral. So there's a lot of weirdness in that regard. You get the other side, which again was borne out just in the last week, with another school shooting and bombings in Austin, just meanness, evil that's in the world. All of that is present. It's just it's a scary thing. And so that's something to recognize. That's the way men are, the default situation when people do not have God, which is another reason for us to try to be active in sharing the gospel message with the world to affect change in our society. God will judge nations that are impenitent and that are ungodly in this way, and if we want to stay that, either delay it or keep it from happening, then the nation needs to repent, and the way in which that's done is through the preaching of the gospel. And you say, well, that's not going to work. Well, it may not. Time and again, it didn't work in Israel, and the pagan nations round about, but that's the effort that we make, and God intends for us to do. Yes.
You know, I think there's nothing new under the sun.
Right.
Under that. But in today's society, we have access to a lot more than we used to have access to. But But that being said, we don't have, at least the way I see, we don't have as much order as we used to have. You know, like you said, up until a few years ago, that would have never been the case, gender-wise, whatever. But I almost wonder if the chaos, it's like when you have a child, you know, you don't say, here's 30 things to pick from, and you give them two, and then they can handle that or whatever. And I can't help but wonder if in younger generation or different, the disrespect and everything, because we don't have some of the order that we used to have. And I still remember there's nothing new under the sun in that way or whatever. But we, in our society today, we do have a big problem with the lack of respect and everything for the for anybody in that way, the elders. And we're very hypocritical. We say a lot of stuff. We don't necessarily believe those things ourselves, but we say them because it's the, what is it? I can't, what do they say? Politically correct.
Yep.
Whatever. But I can't help but wonder if some of the chaos that we have is because of the lack of order. And it seems like it's getting worse to me, but that's just because I'm in this time. And I don't know if it's... Do you know what I'm saying?
I think that if you look at Romans chapter 1 and the progression or digression of society, the pagan societies, that you've got a very real parallel. And so you look at what Paul ascribes to that. And again, God's no longer present, which means... there is no absolute standard that you follow. So individuals do what's right in their own minds. And when you have that, as men forget God, then they become more animal-like, which is chaotic. And where that is impactful to, I think, the greatest extent is with regard to the morals of men. Men begin to act in base manner. And okay, so some will say, what's a base manner? Well, with some people, it's sleeping around, you know, sexual promiscuity. With others, it turns to homosexuality. And then as it progresses and the depravity continues and everything, then you're no telling where it's going to go. It's no different. I mean, when you look at the human sacrifices of the Baal worshippers and Moloch, and you have... bestiality and other kinds of depravities that are mentioned in Scripture as being practiced by men. You know, it's one thing I think is that because of the internet and such, the voices that clamor loudest are heard, and they may not be many, but they're more influential than they have been in the past because there is no one controlling the voice, and so I think it becomes more evident, and because of that, more influential, and so you got kind of a curve that's it's dropping steeply now in our society, but it's no different from other societies. But I think you're right in the sense that it's the rejection of God and His standard that leads to those things, and the farther it goes, the less order there is. You know, the only rule is to break the rules, and as that goes on and on, the end is going to be dissolution, a dissolving and destruction of societal fabric. And again, I was listening to a talk show last night, and one of the points that was being made by an advocate for gun control is that we need to get guns out of the hands of these young people who are emotionally immature and unable to handle their lives because they're only, you know, 17, 18 years old. And there may be some legitimacy to it, especially since we are living in the society that we're living in, where there's a lot of truth to what he's saying, you know, the emotion. But the host countered and said, listen, young people in rural settings for centuries have been hunting and handling guns, and they're not killing people. You know, it's so you're saying they're emotionally incapable. Well, some are capable emotionally. What's the difference?
It's always the bad people that get the guns anyway.
My point's not the guns, though. It's just the fact that, you know, what they're saying is, are we going to fix the problems by controlling guns? It's not going to happen because our society's breaking down. I was telling Deborah that last thing, and I don't know if y'all heard this last night, but there was later last night, there was another incendiary device at a Goodwill in Austin that they think is probably unrelated to the other bombings. The idea is it was a different kind of package, and they don't think the same person's doing it. So that means copycat. Well, are we getting to the point now to where, okay, the guns are going to become passe, and now all of a sudden people who have a reason to be mad at someone, they start doing bombs instead of guns? I mean, it's just it's a scary thing. But the reason, the underlying problem is not those instruments of mass destruction. And I don't like young people having guns. I don't. I'm sorry. I'm a gun advocate in certain ways, but I don't like that, because I know, you know, when Josh comes home and tells me the horror stories of his day teaching juniors in high school American history, and the idea that some of them I could buy a gun and have it scares me half to death. So, but the reason is because of their home life, because of the culture that they've been a part of since they were born. And the fact that they exhibit absolutely no values.
I had heard something on the radio about the video games that the kids watch now. So many of them are very,
very violent. Yeah.
Very violent. And yeah. The younger ones, so many of them don't have any respect for human life.
Yeah. And there's, the same thing if you go to movies and entertainment. Used to where you had the Lone Ranger shooting them up and people falling off horses and no blood being shown. Now the realism that's present is
the good guys always wore the white hats.
Yeah, I know.
And that was actually nighttime TV. That was adult TV.
Yeah.
I watched
that. So it's kind of wild where it's gone. But again, it's not a surprising thing. And for this very reason we're talking about is people have no concept of God or no remembrance of God. Even individuals who will say, I had a little talk that I did on Facebook yesterday. Some of you may get that, but it was on Deuteronomy 29, and the statement of Moses was stating the covenant that the people would have with Jehovah, and the reason for this covenant is so that men would not depart and serve other gods. And so that no one, when they hear about these consequences, would instead say, I'm at peace, even though I follow the dictates of my heart. And that's where we are, is that, everything's okay, God's pleased with me, I believe in God, but I'm going to do what I want to do. And it doesn't work that way. You have to do what God says. And if you do what you want to do, that's the debased mind. So I think the no longer retaining God in their knowledge is not necessarily just individuals who do not believe that God exists, but they think that God's will is irrelevant. That, there's maybe somebody out there who created everything, but I'm going to do what I want to do. And when men just turn to themselves, then the standards go away. Patsy, do you have something?
Actually, I wanted a point of clarification. Laura, you were using... great, that was a phrase. I want to say law and order. Lack of order is what you were using, and then you threw in the word rules. Is that what you meant by lack of order, that we don't have rules?
Yeah, we don't. Well, they don't. We have rules, they just don't. People don't apply them to. We don't follow it. Look at the lack of respect for police, look at the lack of.
Yes.
Yeah. Things that.
Yeah. See, my feelings about that is the lack of order actually is the fault of the parents that have. Sometimes I think we had a generation in here somewhere that was so angry at their parents for being controlled that they just turned around and let their kids grow up wild with this lack of order and no rules.
But it's not just a generation, because I think if we're going to talk about our culture though, 1960s.
That's what I was thinking.
I mean, 1960s was the start of it. But now I'm 1980s. My son is 2000s. Now we're 2020. So now we're in the fourth generation being raised, and with a lot of them, there's less time in between those generations as far as that goes. So you've got grandparents that didn't have that respect for authority. And pretty soon great-grandparents, So we're not talking about a single generation, and that's just the progression, and it is one generation. And I'm not saying that, people in the 1960s, two things happened. Number one, they didn't go as far because they were limited by the standards that were there. But the free love, the drug culture started then, the disrespect for authority that was seen in the rioting and such in the 60s. all of that was present. And then the 80s was the me generation, very much so. I grew up, I'm class of 80 in high school. And in the 70s and 80s, it was very narcissistic. And then, now those are the parents and the grandparents now.
Yeah, the millennials now.
Wow.
Actually, I raised my kids during that era. And yeah, it was difficult because all of those things were going on. Very difficult. I took to sewing because buying clothes that was going to look decent on your child wasn't going to come out of the store.
But you see, so many, is number one, parents don't always do a good job. So where you were fighting against it, others were going with the flow. The point is that you'll see as well what the 60s generation, young people in the 60s, were doing, rebelling against their parents' views and convictions. Every culture has this to a certain extent, at least in modern culture that we've seen, to where the respect for the views and convictions of the previous generation, it's not there.
Yeah.
As a group, not individuals. Yes, I mean, one of the things my kids talk about is how peculiarly they're looked at because of their they mirror the convictions of their parents to a very great extent. Even Kendra, with all the problems that we've had with her and what she's done, she sent us a text just recently expressing how much she appreciated how we raised her and that we were good parents. And here she is with her lifestyle, and yet she still votes Republican. She sent me a note. She said, she voted for Trump. And I told her, I said, well, I didn't. I could bring myself to do that. But there's that in there. But to a very great extent, parents, they don't instill their values sufficiently in their kids. Kids, so each generation goes farther and farther away. And I think that's what I was talking about in Romans 1. It was a culture that he was talking about. They became debased in their thinking because God was no longer remembered. And it reached the point, as Laura referred to today, with the hypocrisy, that they either practice those things or approve of those who practice them.
Yeah.
And that's where we are in our society today. So I would state that unequivocally, no, we're it's not worse today than it has been in the past. In fact, in some ways, not as bad as it has been in the past. The cruelty of Rome, I don't think, is present in America. Just the gladiators, going to watch people kill each other as sport. It's not there. In fact, there are movements against that in our society. But the sexual immorality and promiscuity and the drug use and all that kind of stuff, it's just typical
of
a society that's degrading. Okay. You say,
Deb? Breakdown of the home.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's to a very great extent. That's an interesting discussion.
Judges, in the time of the judges, it was about every 40 years you'd be one, good
women and bad women. Yeah. And, time of the flood, when every man did what was right in his own eyes. So, not necessarily central to our discussion today, but a very interesting discussion nevertheless. I appreciate everyone's input in that regard. And it is makes that point, is that if God's not there, then it goes crazy. And that's exactly what happens. But the counterpoint to that is in verses 4 and 6, and that is with God. So without God, it's meaning the world's evil and the world is crazy. With God, there's hope. And so you'll notice in 9, beginning in verse 4, but for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. I like that. It's a living dog better than a dead lion. And the Jews didn't have much respect for dogs. So he's making a pretty strong point there. For the living know that they'll die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward. For the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love, their hatred, their envy have perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. Now, this is one of those things that kind of... He kind of attributes, and one of the things to keep in mind is what Brother Adams is doing here is he's taking these words and putting them in the Christian context, which everything changes with Christ as far as hope. So the hope is of eternity. But here, I don't know that that's necessarily the application being made. So that's, again, a point to be made here. But there are a couple of things to note here that I think are important. and that is the living know that they'll die. And the point he makes here is that that should supply all the motivation that is needed for them to prepare for that death. It doesn't typically, but for the Christian, of course, it does. One of the primary reasons that we act the way we do is because we believe that it is appointed for man to die once, and after this, the judgment. And so we live in hope because we have prepared for the end, which is death. And so that's the important thing. And so the two things other than that that he mentions in this particular text is number one, in the latter part of verse 5, when it says the dead know nothing, have no more reward, and the memory of them is forgotten, that it's not indicating the idea of nihilism at death. That's not his point. The point that he's making here, and I think it's legitimate that Brother Wilson points this out, is that this life is irrelevant to the individual who's dead. It no longer has any application to him. And he uses as a counterpoint the passage in Luke 16 where Jesus talks about the rich man and Lazarus. And these are individuals who, though dead, did have consciousness, were still aware, and have the three things he mentions here: consciousness, recognition, and memory. But the point is that when we're talking about this life here on this earth, is that, yes, bad things are bad, and people have forgotten God, and things are falling apart, but you're alive. And because you're alive, you can do it right, get it right, which for the Christian and for our understanding, and of course it's the conclusion of his whole premise of his book, is that serving God and keeping his commandments is man's all, our experience living. So as long as you're alive, you've got that ability to handle it and get it right. But once you die, then that's not there anymore. And so I think that's the major point. Now, the second point under letter D is that as a result of death, they no longer have a share in all that is done. And this is a reality that we are all aware of. And I know that all of us do this. And I imagine with regard to those of you who have lost spouses that this would be especially poignant of this paragraph he talks about. But just to let you know, in case you do not, Wilson Adams is Connie Adams' son. And Connie Adams was married to a woman named Bobby. She died at age 53, and he married another woman named Bobby. So there's some confusion sometimes with regard to that. So the wife that he has now, and they've been married for a long while, is not his first wife. His first wife passed away, and that's the individual that Wilson is referring to in this particular paragraph. So he understands that point, that they no longer have a share in all that is done, because his mother passed away before she had the opportunity to see her grandchildren grow up and rejoice and all of those kinds of things. And so she no longer shares in that's done under the sun. But, he says, the day will come when all of us will be joined at the throne and experience the family reunion beyond anything we can comprehend. And so that's the idea, is that the joy is found in eternity. And we all have experienced that loss. So with him, since he said that with his mother, then I think of my father and recognize that same. And Debbie, of course, lost both of her parents. So it's the progression of life that we lose our loved ones. And it never seems fair when it happens.
Yeah, the question. If we have memory, what if some don't make it? I mean, do we have memory? Would that affect us in heaven?
No, it won't. I don't know how it won't. I don't know how it won't.
Do we remember the good and the bad?
You know, I don't think we can contemplate it. I think when it talks about the transformation of our body to that which is incorruptible and immortal, and then I look at what Jesus said when they said, you know, they all had a wife and then they died and she died, and whose wife will she be? He said, you err not knowing the resurrection. They neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like the angels in heaven. So it's going to be completely different. And this reunion that he's talking about, I don't think he's saying that they're necessarily, he doesn't know. So you can't say that, okay, we're going to see each other again and we're all going to hug each other and rejoice that we're together again. That's not the point. The point is that he knows his mother was a Christian, and so he knows that she has the hope of life. His father has the hope of life. He has the hope of life. So we're all going to be in heaven, and it's going to be a wonderful thing. And so, no, I think that any time, and you hear people talk about this a lot, you'll even hear preachers that will talk about it at funerals and such, about, you know, we're going to go see him again and there's going to be a wonderful reunion and all that kind of stuff. We can't know those things. We don't know what it's going to be like other than what is told of us. And if we begin to try to put our present limitations, perceptions, emotions, and feelings into eternity, then we can't get it accurately. We can't figure it out, because I cannot contemplate being happy, being in heaven, if someone that I love dearly is in hell and is not there. Is there an indication of memories and understanding beyond the grave? What we have is Luke 16, which indicates that in the Hadean world, there certainly is. But at the same time, let's say that, you know, all we hear about is a rich man's memory of his brothers, and his desire as a part of his suffering is that they would escape his fate. What about Lazarus? Was Lazarus mourning the fact that some of his loved ones, individuals that he knew, weren't righteous? No, he was comforted by Abraham. So whatever it is in that state, and certainly in the Hadean world, but most certainly in heaven, is that those concerns will not be present. You know, as we contemplate it, we can't be happy. It's not going to be there, because we will have supreme happiness. And that's just the way it is. And I don't know how, but I know it is that way.
No, it's not like a lot of people think about, play golf in heaven.
Oh, no.
You know,
no.
I mean, so many people, that's what they kind of think of.
No, I'm hoping to make my hole in one before I get there. If I ever do. And no, it's kind of funny. Josh went with golfing with some friends of his. He wrote back, and he wrote me a text, and he said, "Guess what happened on the course today?" And I thought, man, he had a hole in one. I said, "Did you have a hole in one?" He said, "No." I said, "Well, good, because I want to be there when you make one. I don't want to miss that." And I said, "So you broke par?" "No." It turned out he outdrove a guy that hits the ball a long ways, and that was his joy for the day. You know, he had never done that, but he did. So, but yeah, we rejoice in things on this earth, but we don't have any way of comparing what that's going to be like. And even the language we're given, and the words, the descriptions that we're given, I think it's basically simply to assure us that the incomprehensible will happen, because we can't comprehend it. I mean, when you look at the language that is given of heaven in the book of Revelation, the imagery that is given of a street of gold and gates of pearl and the precious stones and all that kind of stuff, you know, it's a place that's different than this material universe. And it's an indication of its glory that we're not going to be able to comprehend. We just aren't, until we get there. But when we get there, it's going to be good. And that's all we have to worry about. And, of course, work as hard as we can to get everybody that we love to go with us. Yeah, because we want them. Not because we'll be less happy if they don't, but because we want them to be as happy as we will be. That's the key way to look at it. Okay, so anyway, that was very poignant to me as I read that, and I thought about my own father in regard to it. But that concept of the hope of eternity is what gives us comfort as Christians. And why funerals without that hope are so difficult. But there is that measure of comfort that we receive when we know the individual we're mourning has the hope of life. All right, questions, comments?
Yeah. Really quick, I was just going to say, I think a lot of the world fears death because they don't know. I have a fear of death in that way because of what I do know of hell. I mean, versus heaven. You know, I want to be on the good side of that. But I think the world, a lot of people don't believe in that, which is very... It's a lovely thought, but they don't know if it's real. So they don't have that healthy fear of hell.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Makes no sense to me. You know, if you think about that we're saying, okay, we're here on this earth for 80 years plus. Maybe we make it that far. And then you have individuals that will spend an eternity, or this is the concept. There may be something after this life, and what the Christians are saying is so, then it's going to be eternity, and it's either going to be eternity in a really good place or a really bad place. I don't know if I believe that. Well, then look into it. why are you not trying to figure out whether it's legitimate or not, and just assuming that if it happens, then I'll be in a good place. it just makes no sense. That's what we were talking about, is that this knowledge that we will die, and that there is hope as long as we're alive, should be motivation for us to prepare, to find out, to try to figure it out. And yet so many people just absolutely are uninterested. And I think that's the nearsightedness of the perspective people have. I'm always reminded of 2 Peter 1, where it talks about diligently adding to your faith virtue, godliness. You go through that process. Because he who lacks these things is short-sighted, even to blindness, having forgotten he was cleansed from his sins. So that's for the Christian. The Christian can lose sight of eternity and begin to live more worldly, and just not even think about those things. So it shouldn't surprise us that the world in general doesn't think about those things, but it does. At least it surprises me. Why? When I talk to people about their eternal welfare, and they blow me off, I just don't get it. I don't understand it. But it happens quite often.
I went, of course, to the Baptist church before I met you, and they showed
a long time ago.
They showed. I think I was in junior high, and they showed the film on. I don't know what it's
Rapture.
Yes. And it was very graphic. It was, one will be taken and one will be left. And so it showed car wrecks, the driver taken. I just cannot get that out of my mind. It scared me. So, a good healthy dose of fear.
It motivates some of us, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, that whole thing was wrong, but kids have no fear these days, like we were talking earlier.
Good point.
Yeah, God's just a casual friend. So with a lot of power, but casual.
But that's the same as today, though. When Christ comes again, those of us that are alive will be caught up with him. So what are the other people? What are they going to be?
Well, everyone is going to be resurrected to judgment in that day. Yeah, the difference between the rapture is they take the text to where we will rise to meet him in the air, and thus we shall ever be with the Lord, is that that's only referring to Christians. The resurrection of the dead is the just and the unjust, and other passages teach that very clearly. So the problem is with the concept of the rapture, which means being caught up. That's why the term rapture was coined, is that they take the text of 1 Thessalonians where the question was, what's going to happen to dead Christians? That's what he was being asked. And he was answering, the dead Christians will be raised to be with the Lord forever. That was his answer. And they're saying, well, all it's talking about is dead Christians there, so there's going to be two resurrections, one of the Christians, and then at a later time, one of the unjust. Well, that was, no, the question, if they had asked the question, what's going to happen to all the dead? He's going to say, well, the Christian will be rise up to be with the Lord and be with him forever, and then the dead will be rise up to judgment and be sent to hell. That would be his answer, but that's not what the question was. So it's a misunderstanding of context. And a taking of a passage to fit a conception that they want to have based upon very convoluted reasoning. One day of judgment and the resurrection of all men. But that was just his way of telling them, don't worry about those who have already died. They're not going to be left behind. They will not precede them. They'll be raised up, will be transformed. And that was his answer to the question. Okay, page 44. We don't have a lot of time to discuss this, but there's some good points to hear, and that is, okay, we've talked about good and bad here, and I think maybe emphasized the doom and gloom up to this point in the section we've looked at. But that idea, if we're alive, we have hope. How do we respond to how bad life is right now? And the idea is, don't let it get you down. You've got the truth. You're in a good state. You of all people have the reason to be happy with your life. So live your life rejoicing. And there are two things to keep in mind with regard to that, and that is, it's not simply saying that we need to have that mindset that, okay, my reward is later, and so I'm going to suffer with a smile on my face. We're going to have enough need for that, because things are bad are going to happen to us when we have a smile on our face. But we were created and put on this earth by a benevolent God who loves us and wants us to be happy on this earth too. And there are a lot of things that we can enjoy, and we can do so justly without disobeying God, and enjoy yourself and have fun on earth. And I say have fun. I mean, he mentions fun as a part of that, but have a fulfilling life while you're living here on earth too. And I think that sometimes we as Christians have become fatalistic. And maybe in some of my preaching in the last year or two, the elders had asked me a while back, and it started with that series of lessons of victory in Jesus that we had in that Bible class, where, you know, we're some people in the congregation going through health problems and difficult times, and so, you know, preach and teach on that some. And I hope that my preaching and teaching haven't led you to think that, oh yeah, well, we're just going to be miserable in this life and look to heaven, because that's not the intent of it. It is that when we have miserable things happen to us, we can have joy because we're looking to heaven. But we certainly need to embrace the life that we have on this earth. Enjoy your families. Enjoy your children. Enjoy your grandchildren. Enjoy your work. Enjoy your hobbies. Have all of that, because it's all been given to you. And I like the way it's put in verses 7 and 8. More specifically, the one phrase. He says, go eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart. And by the way, that's, again, go into this, he's not saying you get drunk at all. He said, God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, and let your head lack no oil. Let your garments always be white, and your head lack no oil. Those are general terms. Black is the color of mourning. White is the color of rejoicing. There will be times when it is appropriate. He even says this previous in this book, Ecclesiastes 3, time for mourning, time for laughing. There will be times when black is appropriate dress. But an individual who just walks through his entire life like the Pharisees, wearing sackcloth and ashes in order to be seen of men, and wearing black and just being miserable all his life, you're missing the point. There's much to live for as we live here on this earth. And his phrase is the end of that chat, in that paragraph: dress up, slick down your hair, and live guilt free. Now, you know, that could be taken if it wasn't understood in the context. I like the way he put it, because it's basically what Solomon said, just using our vernacular. But taken out of the context, and that would say live guilt free, it is, you know, don't worry about anything because you're all right. God's going to accept you regardless. That's not what it's saying. It's saying that because you are serving God, because your works have been accepted, you have a reason to rejoice. Don't be in a situation where you're in mourning always or unhappy. Enjoy yourself. God wants you to have an enjoyable and full life. And you can, because you're right with Him. And as long as we're right with Him, the Christian, above all men, and only among men, has the right to be in a default state of rejoicing. And it certainly is something that we can have. And so there are a couple of things that are mentioned here. Celebrating every moment. Being committed to your marriage, verse 9, which states, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which He has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. See, that is a mixed message right there, in the sense, not mixed as in he's contradicting himself, but he's basically saying, again, this life is not what it's all about. But the portion that God gave you in this life is to enjoy these things. And so be committed to your marriage. Love your wife. Live joyfully with your wife. This is what God wants you to have as you live under the sun. And for the individual who is living on this earth under the sun physically, but he has the mindset of eternity in heaven, then, I mean, you just look at the marriages of faithful Christians who got the right concept of things, how joyous they are. And, you know, whenever we find in our you know, Christians unfortunately are influenced by culture, and I have had a number of occasions to counsel with families, husbands, wives that are not happy, and I know of individuals who have been divorced, and actually counseled again with individuals who ultimately got divorced. And what you find in that case is, yes, they are Christians, but they aren't doing it as Christians should do it. In other words, there is a weakness spiritually in them. They're not acting like a husband's supposed to act or a wife is supposed to act. Their focus is not on spiritual things. Because if that's the case, then on both parts, with both people, then the marriage is a happy marriage. And it's a wonderful marriage. It's when that isn't the case that the problems come into the relationship. So, again, when you look at the best marriages on earth, what you find are two committed Christians who are fulfilling their duties to one another and to God. And that's the way it should be. Okay, so be committed to your marriage. Verse 10 of the text, give life 110%. And this one, again, is a kind of an interesting thing. Because when you look at that, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going. Would seem to think that you're talking about work, the work that you do. But it doesn't actually say that. Work is a part of it, certainly. But, you know, again, when you say, what is one of the most destructive slogans of our culture? Go for the gusto. You only got to go around once in life. It's the eat, drink, and be merry mentality. But actually, the wise man here is also saying eat, drink, and marry, and be merry, and go for the gusto. It's just the point of view. Do it with God first, not without God in the picture. And as a result of that, you can throw yourself into those things that you do. He says, don't hold back. Don't save your strength. What are you saving it for anyway? Don't put off living until you retire. Stop saying one of these days. Have a blast now. Make some memories. That's the point. And I think that's legitimate. Again, the way he says it sometimes almost sounds a little superficial, but there's a lot of truth to enjoying your life because it is your lot that God has given you on earth. And then the final one in this section, and we've got five more minutes, is, and by the way, if you want to add anything to any of these, let me know. But the final one is verse 11. This is where I think he got it wrong a little bit, because he's saying these are the positive things, how to get most out of life. Be satisfied with who you are. Well, verse 11 says, I return and saw under the sun that race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor the bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. Well, the point that he's making there is not to be satisfied with who you are at all. It doesn't have anything to do with that. Verse 11 can't be understood properly unless verse 12 is read along with it. So again, I returned, saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor the bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to the all. For man also does not know his time, like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare. So the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. So the idea is that if you place your trust in the fact that you're the fastest, or that you're the strongest, or that you're the wisest, or you're the richest, or you're the most skilled, and you think that because that is the case, that you, number one, have more value, and number two, you have control, you're wrong. It doesn't work that way. Time and chance happen to them all, and even those who are rich, those who are powerful, those who are wise or knowledgeable, they suffer whenever circumstances bring them, like a fish caught in a cruel net. And that brings to my mind James 4 with regard to the vagaries of life. What is your life? It's even a vapor that appears a little while and then vanishes away. We don't have that hope of tomorrow. We don't have that ability. And it's arrogant for us to say that because I'm strong, I'm swift, I'm rich, I'm knowledgeable, and I have control of my life. It's wrong to think that way. That's the application there, which isn't a positive application, it's an admonition. But having said that, this is where we can bring this point that he makes in. As we look at all of those rich, influential, powerful people, and it is possible for us to be either envious or to feel that we are less than they, because we don't have those things. And that's not what life is all about at all. So the idea is, don't try to become someone else, just be the best you can be. Well, there are plenty of passages which teach that. The parable of the talents is one, but that's really not what this passage is saying. So that's kind of when, a few times when he does this through the book, to where he's straining a little bit to make an application that really isn't the primary one, that I have some objections. So I think once it gets into verse 11, going down through verse 18 of the text, it actually kind of gets negative in tone again, in the sense of he's bringing up his premise of the entire book again concerning the evil. Now, the final words of wisdom, basically he said all he wants to in this particular lesson. I think some of the best stuff is in 12 through 18, so I don't want to rush through that. I'd like to spend a little time talking about those final words of wisdom, especially beginning with verses 16 through 18. I think there's some really good thoughts that we want to establish. Just kind of end up with that today matter, so make it matter, is the idea of enjoy yourself, but keep your perspective concerning eternity and God and obey Him. And enjoy your life is a good thing for us to know. So we can pick up with the final words of wisdom in our discussion next week, if you don't mind. And, so that kind of gives me, or finishes all that I wanted to share with you. We've got a minute or two. Does anyone have anything about this list that we've looked at that you would like to add to?
Well, I think that